martyrdom. Where you're not pictured as a Christian dying for his faith, you're pictured as a nut. And in my opinion, the vast, vast majority of the kind of Christians we're creating, the kind of Christian we're doing, are going to be absolutely unable to stand up in that kind of stuff. I think not 2%, not 3% of Christians are sure in any way equipped to face that kind of struggle. I hope I'm wrong about that. I think less than half of our students are in the Fourth Bible College. Totally irrational view of the relationship between the church and the state now. Like this Ten Commandments, you know, wanting prayer in schools, Christians for prayers in schools, all this business, for instance, and the idea that the public school system is somehow sacrosanct. And we're just not instructed, not trained. Not up here in Castleberry, you know, he's becoming a mistake. Well, I just don't see the kind of maturity it's going to take, the wisdom, the understanding it's going to take to withstand it. My point I'm making, I'm laboring for death, is this, that I do not think it necessarily means that it may not be easily identifiable. It's certainly not a sign, because, first of all, it's been going on for several decades already in various parts of the world. It's been going on for a long time. And secondly, I don't think it's going to be easy to identify. In other words, I don't think they're going to be able to look at what's going on and say, aha, this is the surrounding of the camp of the saints. This is the battle. This is it. I think it's going to look like a battle. You get my point? It's going to be very subtle and gradual, masked, camouflaged, misidentified, misunderstood, misrepresented. And by the way, if you don't think states can do this, you realize that often, you know, the Germans are often condemned. The German nation is roundly condemned for what happened to the Jews. As a matter of fact, the German population did not know what was happening. They simply did not know. It was done so subtly, so gradually, and with such finesse, they did not know. Now, many of you did. Many did know. Many suspected. But there was no, it was never clear. It was not quite clear to them. Well, so is that, any questions or comments on that? That's very serious business, by the way. One of the things I think is going to hurt American Christians is that American Christians, by and large, play church. We play games. Church. Our church is mostly a fun time. It's usually fun and games. I can say that, but it really is. The general tenor of our church life does not reflect the deadly sobriety and gravity of the issues involved. I mean, when's the last time you went to church? The gospel was preached, and the things of heaven and earth were dead, and the things of the death and eternity and judgment to come were dealt with, and you really got the impression that this is a matter of life and death. It just is there, isn't it? Not that. Critical view of it, but I hope I'm wrong. I hope very much I'm wrong. But I think when we often think that in the early Christian centuries, listen, in the early Christian centuries, when the issues were very clear, and when the it was simply a clear-cut decision, vast numbers of Christians gave in. Remember the Donatists and the Novatian heresies, the problems they had, vast numbers gave in. When the issues were very clear. How many are going to remain faithful when the issues are not there? And see, what communists do, their method is that you don't ask the other side to surrender everything all at once. You ask them to surrender just a little bit. And a little bit they surrender, it shouldn't make that much difference. attrition, they wear down. But this can be like that. Well, let me give you an actual question. What happened to your home church? What happened to the budget in your home church? Well, all of a sudden it became illegal for people to live, to take a tax deduction for the church giving.
Yeah, it would go down.
Think it seriously hurt the church? I hope it wouldn't. I'm afraid it would. Which I use as a, that's the kind of thing I'm talking about. When I talk about using the barometer, the depth of maturity and perception of our churches. Well, that's my spooky lecture for this quarter. Questions on Revelation 20? Not to suggest that every question has been answered, but Ezekiel 38-39 for a little bit, and we saw a reference in the Revelation 20 to Gog and Magog. Chapter 38 in particular. The word of the Lord came to me saying, Son of man, set your face toward Gog of the land of Magog, prince of Rosh, Meshach, and Tubal, and prophesy against him. And they can say, thus says the Lord God, behold, I am against you, O Gog, prince of Rosh, Meshach, and Tubal. Will turn you about and hooks in your jaws, and will bring you out, and all your army, horses, and horsemen, all them splendidly attired, accompanied with buckler and shield, and all them building swords, Persia, Ethiopia, and Put with them, all them shield and helmet, Gomer with all his troops, Beth Togdamah, and all parts of the north with all his troops, many peoples with you. The enemy from the north, he brings them together for this great battle. And chapter 39 starts out, and you, son of man, prophesy against Gog and say, thus says the Lord God, behold, I am against you, O Gog, prince of Rosh, Meshach, and Tubal. And then the chapter proceeds with the terrible destruction of Gog's hordes and the burial of them. Now, this, of course, Ezekiel 38-39 are key prophecies made so, not necessarily by the because of their own nature, but because they are much used by a modern eschatologist from the dispensational school. We are warned, for instance, that since the The modern state of Israel is going to be endangered and threatened attack by Gog, the land of Magog, the prince of Rosh, Meshach, and Tubal. And there's going to be a great battle. And the forces of good and God are going to win. Now, it's quite a, you read these chapters, we didn't take time to read all of them. These oracles prophesy how Israel is threatened, and the terrors of heaven are summoned against the Gogian hordes. They are destroyed by torrential rains, hailstone, fire, and brimstone. Then in bitter derision, God, the God of Israel, calls the carrion-eating birds, the buzzards, to the sacrificial feast which he himself has prepared. Discarded weapons serve as fuel for the home fire of Israel for 7 years. Then the oil is getting expensive. burial details are 7 months behind in their work. So summarizing here, the nations of the Goyim learn the great lesson they all have to blaspheme the name of Yahweh. And this is very enigmatic. Very enigmatic chapter, and as you probably know, the dispensational school projects this to the future, as they do everything they possibly can, and Lindsay again, we took these hymns off, good boy. Chapter 5, the title of chapter 5 of Lindsay's book, Russia is a God. in space we can learn that's to be a God. What's that? The new state of Israel will be, in the future, plagued by a certain pattern of events which have been clearly forecasted. Look at him. Shortly after the restoration of the Jews in the land of Israel, an incredible angel will arrive to the uttermost north, which is the northern confederacy. And he goes on to identify this enemy from the north. However, he heard this argument, to draw a line north, straight north from Jerusalem or go to Moscow. It's interesting. The problem with this is that except for Egypt, all of Israel's enemies came from the north. Even though they came from the west, because you know this, don't you? The enemy always came from the north because of the great desert. And then when Babylon attacked Jerusalem, they came from the north. And we're going to see if the enemy is talking about here or not in the rest of the room here in Minor, and you call it Minor. They would come from the north too. So the idea of identifying the enemy by direction simply comes from the north. That's very silly because they all come from the north. Understand that? Whether it's other than Egypt. Well, he identifies these people the following way. Gog is the symbolic name of the nation's leader, Magog his land. He is also a prince of the ancient people who are called Rosh, Meshach, and Tubal. Now, of course, these are names which go back to Genesis in the Table of Nations, but here's the identification. He gets the various identifications of the following identifications are given by Lindsay, and this is the stand, this is all center dispensationalism. Gog and Magog are the Scythians, the ancient Scythian people, who are the people of the north, and the identification is made, the Scythians were people lived under this one of the Black Sea. Were very fierce people. The Scythians were the prince in Siberia, Scythian tombs have been found, frozen tombs, and because they were frozen, they are in a marvelous state of preservation. And evidence comes from the Scythian tomb that they practice scalping, for instance. They were buried with their horses. Herodotus tells about Scythians being buried on their horses, warriors, in great circles. Part of the horses, but this has been confirmed in the Scythian tombs. They were very fierce people, and they were known for that great, terrible, great warriors. Well, anyway, and modern Russians are identified as the ancient Scythians. Meshek is Moscow. You can tell that by just the name of the sound. He cites on page 64 of this particular edition of Wilhelm Gesenius, a great Hebrew scholar of the early 19th century, discusses these words in his unsurpassed Hebrew lexicon. Now, as a matter of fact, it has been surpassed, not unsurpassed. Gesenius was a early 1800s, the early 19th century, philologist. He was writing before the age of archaeology, before the age of cuneiform records. He was working with the information he had. But he cited, as Meshek, he said, was the founder of Moski, a barbarous people who dwelled in the Moskian Mountains. This scholar, they want to cite somebody who really used him, he's a scholar. Nobody else does that. This scholar wanted to say the Greek name Moski, derived from the Hebrew name Meshek, is the source of the name for the city of Moscow. Gesenius is the standard source on this. And Rosh, which of course is the German word for head or chief, of course means Russia, people of the Russian peoples. So the peoples in general are the Scythians. God is the head of the Scythians. Meshek is Moscow, the modern city of the ancient Scythians. And Tubal is Tobolsk, which is a Russian city. I'll take that out, but it sounds nice. Roche, he cites another scholar, Bishop Lolith of England, in 1710. You guys have this for a minute. He uses the latest scholarship. He starts off with one that's about 1810, goes back another 100 years, 1710. He wrote in 1710, Rosh, taken as a proper name in Ezekiel, signifies the inhabitants of Scythia, from whom the modern Russians derive their name. That is the general identification. And this is the standard identification. You're familiar with that, weren't you? Okay. Kush is supposed to be the Marxist-oriented black African nation. By the way, Kut is by the way, Kush, Kush Lindsay interprets as being black. Let's see. Who are the allies? Persia, Kush, the black African nation. He says this. He goes back, he cites Dr. Gesenius again. He was recognized as one of the great scholars of history. We're black men. By the way, Kush is generally translated Ethiopia. He goes on, Persia is, to make a long story short, he identifies Put as Libya, Gomer as East Germany. You can hear how Gomer and Germany sound very close together. By the way, the way that Lindy identifies it, Gog and Magog are the Scythians in general. In particular, Meshach is Moscow, the city of the Scythians. Tubal is Tobolsk, the city of the Scythians. Rosh is Russia. Persia is the United Arab Republic. Cush is Black African nations. Put is Libya. Gomer is East Germany, interestingly enough. By the way, he goes on. And the picture is that Russia is going to make an alliance with some of the communist nations of Black Africa and with some of the Mideast states, such as the United Arab States, and all of them descend on Russia, on Jerusalem, on the state of Israel. By the way, this is an old theme, the idea of, for instance, remember Millerism? I discussed Millerism in the foundational movement in Seventh-day Adventism and Jehovah's Witnesses. Millerites used to sing an old hymn. We are living, we are dwelling in a grand and awful time, in an age on ages telling. To be living is sublime. Hark the waking of the nations. Gog and Magog through the fray. Well, probably this was written about 1810. So far, Gog and Magog have not come to the fray. Or anywhere else, I've heard. But this is the general approach. To summarize, are you confused this morning?
Mm-hmm.
Well, basically, what he does is he identifies that this is a modern dispensational thing, this is a very common view, that this Ezekiel 30, number one, Ezekiel 38 and 39 talk about a future, an eschatological battle, our future, a literal battle, and in this, it will be Russia and this general scheme of identification that has Russia as the modern Scythians, modern descendants of the ancient Scythians, and then particularized identifications which, you know, Meshach, Moscow, Tubals, Tobols, and Russia's going to form an alliance with East Germany, Gomer, some of the Cush and Put. They're appearing in North Africa, communist nation, and then Persia, the United Arab States, they're all going to come together sometime in the near future upon Jerusalem. Get that? It's going to be a great battle. It's going to be a nuclear war. That's why they get to the place. We go along and guard. It's going to be terrible. The Lord's going to step in and rescue Israel in this. But the fundamental identification, let me sort of cut through and focus you in. The fundamental question is it eschatological? Is it in our future? Well, that might be three questions. Is it the future, our future? Second, is it a literal battle? Or is this apocalyptic language pointed at something that's not literal? Or is it hyperbole? You know, that kind of obviously is. Third, is the enemy Russia, the central enemy, the organizing enemy, the Scythian people, with the North? Okay? Is it future? Is it literal? Is it Russia? Okay? That's the basic question. Does that help you? Well, they say yes, it's future. Yes, it's literal. Yes, it's Russia, Scythian people. Now, and I would simply point this very important. This remember I said, and I'm kind of approaching this. Remember I said that dispensationalism sort of had to set up its own school, had to go into business for itself because it could not penetrate these established evangelical seminaries of higher learning. Well, we're just going to see this later. But here you've got a guy who's citing two authorities. One is around 1820. The other 1710. How would you like to go to a doctor who's treated you based on medical books, the earliest of which was 1810? Or the latest of which, I mean, was 1810. Would you like to do that? What they do is, this procession, they cite Vizanius. They love Vizanius. They cite Vizanius and the ones before him, and then as for modern scholarship, by the way, that's the the primary sources. And then when they wanted to cite modern sources, they cite each other. Like a liberal, you know, he learned this in college, one of the higher education. Liberals have a very interesting way of proving things. They go along an argument until they get to a gap in the evidence, and jump the gap in the evidence by citing each other. And the liberals got a rule, and nobody's ever written it down or explained it, but they all follow it, and that's this, that you can cross-reference, you cite each other three times, and after the third time it becomes scholarship. If three of them say it's true, it must be true. And the angels applaud at the great wisdom. But and dispensationalists follow the same scheme. They cite each other, and they cite secondary sources, tertiary sources, and much beyond that. Well, the Scythian people, I've already identified the people. The Scythians I've already identified them as very fierce people. Now, Gesenius identified this, made the basis on etymological connections, sounds. Let's first look at Meshech and Tubal. Meshech and Tubal.
What's spelled
Gesenius? Gesenius? G-E-S-E-N-I-U-S. Now, first of all, the fact is that since Gesenius wrote, and again, Gesenius had very little to work with. Gesenius was a good scholar, but what he had to work with. But Gesenius had little more than etymologies to work with, trying to trace language, similarities in sound. Since 1800s, certainly since 1710, a lot of information has come available from that part of the world, the ancient world. Been a veritable revolution. And there have been two schools of learning, among others, two at least, which have been categorically upset by the findings of the great body of cuneiform literature. One school of thought which has been upset by the cuneiform literature and has largely ignored it is the school of radical German theology. You recall the JEDP, Graf Bellhausen evolutionary approach. Well, the basic, the foundational premises of that theory were blown out of the water, and have been out of the water, been dead in the water for a long time, by the work of the Baltimore School of Archaeology, founder of which is William Boswell Albright, and such scholars as Sojourner Wright and Nelson Glick and the others. Wilson and on. Anyway, that's not the subject we're getting at this class, but the point is, they have shown that the fundamental propositions of the Graf-Bellhausen scenario are no longer tenable. They cannot be defended. But they're still being taught. And I think I mentioned before, out of the university. In the history department, that approach was laughed at on the basis of the internet. There was still being taught in the religion department. Because if three Germans say it, it must be true. And so there has arisen in the field of archaeology and history the two schools, two approaches. There is the one school, which is called the German school, which tends to ignore the archaeological evidence and go ahead merrily on their way. The second school is the British Israeli-American Archaeological School, called all three, the British School, the American School, the Archaeological School, Israeli School of Archaeology, the British, American, Israeli. That is, these are these scholars, are willing to re-examine and adjust theories based upon the evidence. There's a big war going on now. And you know, the reason is, of course, the reason that the old theory in critical scholarship cannot be abandoned, as I've talked other times perhaps, is this, that you have a whole body of scholars who are the architects of the conventional wisdom in that field, whose PhD dissertations, whose academic careers, all the books, his published works, all reflect that basic approach. And if that basic approach is found defective, well, you just wash out the academic respectability of whole departments of universities, especially in Germany and in the East Coast of the United States, in Chicago. That is, you simply declare wanting all kinds of dissertations, books, journal articles, academic careers, curriculi, so forth. It's like, what would happen to modern biology if people would, if they would accept the... This has happened, by the way. You see this in, I'm kind of far afield now, but this is college, you'll learn something. You see, we often think that scholars are, secular scholars are objective men of science who go where the evidence drives them. Well, I've done business with that outfit, take my word for it, that ain't so. What happens is that, let's see, what happened is, and I think you all learned this, that at the turn of the century, in the late 19th century, early 20th century, there was a revolution in scholarship. Everything was reinterpreted. Everything. Biblical studies, theology, comparative religion, psychology, history even, science certainly. Everything was reoriented to evolution. Everything was reinterpreted, re-explained in terms of progressive development. Everything, society, life, there was a biological order, a biological realm, sociological, economics, the communism is just economic evolution. And everything was reoriented within a period of about 70 years. It's a whole new ball game. And a whole new basis was laid for psychology, history, science, religion, everything, beginning in Germany largely. Now, that same period, say roughly from 1849, I think Darwin's Origin of Species was published, to, say, 1920. Roughly in that period, everything was rewritten, and a whole new approach to scholarship was created. And in this period, for instance, curriculi, schools, and universities were established. You know, catalogs were drawn up, PhD dissertations were published, books were written by the ton, and the whole approach was worked out. It was a genuine, cataclysmic, intellectual revolution. Yes?
Excuse me. The school of this radical German society, I don't understand, they stick with Gesenius? They're backing
up? I'm talking about, that doesn't deal with Gesenius. I'm just speaking in general terms now, the approach to scholarship.
Did they accept, they had accepted his...
Yes, he was a... Well, he didn't really count. I'm talking about liberalism now. I'm trying to show you a methodology of approach. And so it doesn't really have anything to do with Gesenius. I'm trying to see the general way of... I'm trying to give you a general concept of how scholarship works and doesn't work. Well, what happened is that this period, say 1850-1920, was also, not only was this the period of rewriting scholarship, restructuring, it was a period in this period you had, it was the birth, it was the infant years of hard sciences, biology, chemistry, genetics, even archaeology. And what happened was that these theories were worked out, and basically here's what happened, that these theories
the poly, basically the evolutionary approach to everything. These theories, now listen to me, they became scholarship before the evidence was in. That is, the evidence, much of it hadn't even started coming in yet, but before the evidence came in, these theories became scholarship. One of the reasons they became scholarship was they offered seemingly intellectual alternatives to the biblical approach. The promise was, in each of these disciplines, well, this is how it works, and the evidence will bear this out. Well, the scientific methodology is that if the evidence doesn't bear you out, you change your hypothesis, right? That's the way it works. The problem is, if the evidence began to come in, it didn't work out, it did not bear out these basic theories. You see, it's an evolution, for instance. The evidence would show, but that it didn't. In fact, you find, for instance, whereas you find scientists, leading, really respectable scientists, convinced of the evolutionary process and the mechanisms involved in 1910, you find them less convinced now. Do you realize that there are thousands and thousands more creationists in the biology, that is, in the hard sciences, the universities now, more than there were in 1940? In 1940, a creationist would lose his job at a university campus. He's taught in the area of botany, biology, zoology, physics, chemistry. Now, that's not true at all. As a matter of fact, the head of the zoology department at my university was not an evolutionist when I went there. What's happened? Well, the evidence has begun to come in. And all of a sudden, but why isn't it being accepted? The answer is because it would destroy the structure of modern biology. That is, you would simply wipe out, you might as well drop a bomb on every major university in the country. Well, most of the books become useless. The academic credentials of most of the professors are negated. The textbooks are worthless. In the classroom, the whole, so, I mean, you, there's too much to lose. When I came down, when I moved down here, the head of the anthropology department, the old godfather at the University of Cincinnati, was on the verge of suicide. The simple reason, the findings of Leakey had made his dissertation and three of his books totally outdated, totally worthless. His whole academic career went down, was almost going down the drain. So they go on teaching it. Same thing happened in the area of history and religion. That is, why do the liberals reject the archaeological approach to ancient history? The answer is, it would simply wipe them off the map. Well, it just wiped out the whole business. For instance, if you accepted the logical conclusions of the American British Israeli School of Archaeology, the religion department at my university, for instance, where I went, the religion department would have to be wiped out and start from it, right, rewrite the curriculum, get a whole new faculty, all new textbooks, add more books to the library, simply dismantle it. And so they don't change it. Now, interestingly enough, the dispensationalists, I like this because dispensationalism, like politics, makes strange bedfellows. Dispensationalism and fundamentalism go together. Fundamentalism is a basically non-intellectual approach to biblical truth. And yet, the strange thing is how Lindsay finds himself agreeing with the basic liberal approach to scholarship. And I said all that so I can say this. It's very interesting that the dispensationalists, while being fundamentalists, and if anybody hates a liberal, the dispensationalist, I mean, they hate him. And yet, they find themselves agreeing in methodology, to wit, that you ignore the latest evidence in order to preserve your theory. That is, what I'm saying is that Hal Lindsey is using the same evidence that William Miller used. And this identification. Well, what William Miller did in 18th century, early 19th century. Died in 1850, something like that. You got that? using the same sources. Now, is it? That's interesting, isn't it? Well, what is the latest evidence? Well, the fact is that the cuneiform records are coming in, and as a matter of fact, whereas Gesenius could not identify on the basis of objective evidence, his identification was based on philological speculation. He sort of worked deductively backwards and guessed at it. The evidence is in now. Well, who are, for instance, do you know that Meshech and Tubal have been identified? They can be Assyrian cuneiform records. I have it right here in front of me. Text read, this is the age of Sargon. This is the empire which destroyed the northern kingdom. Listen to this. Palace of Sargon, great king, the mighty king, king of the universe, king of Assyria, viceroy of Babylon, he's very humble. King of Sumer and Akkad, the king who with the help of Asher, his god, Nabu and Marduk, other gods, beginning with Yatnatna, that's Cyprus, which is in the midst of the sea of the setting sun, to the border of Egypt and to the land of Mushki, or Meshech. The wide land of Amuru, Hatti, with its entirety, the Hatti land, the Hittites. I'm sorry, the Hatti land, this was Israel, it was called the Hatti land. And all of Gudium, the distant bees on the edge of the Bikini, the Bikini Mountain. He said, I started here, and I went all, put them all in. Now, Mushki, here's another record. This is from the Louvre in the British Museum. Listen to this. This is a cylinder inscription of Sargon again. He's telling about all the land that he didn't mention the Hittites here, which is different from the Hatti land. Whose strong arm conquered from Hashmar to Shemeshpati, the distant Medes of the east, the lands of the Namri, Alippi, Bit Habman, Parsual, the Menean land, Urartu, that's Armenia, Kasku, Tabulum, Tubal, you see, up to the land of Mushki. Now, and the Hittite record that Mushki appeared, you have Tobal and Meshech, Tobal up to the land of the Mushki. Well, to make a long story short, it's very clear from the cuneiform record that Tobal, that the Mushki and the land of the Mushki, or Mushki and the land of Tabulum, or the Tobal, were ancient names of the Phrygian peoples, not the Scythians. Phrygian peoples lived here in eastern Anatolia, as it was called in that ancient period. And a good map showed that this map isn't good. That is, identification, rather than being from the Scythians, as Gesenius said, not the Scythians at all, the Phrygian people. Probably not up here, not up into Europe, but in Anatolia. It's listed, right? And he lists all these people they conquered, the Hittites from here, and they were Phrygian peoples in eastern Anatolia. Anatolia is area right in here. Well, interestingly enough, Gesenius was wrong. By the way, he mentions Gomer. Now, Gomer were the ancient Cimmerians, which were a people up in here, the Caucasus Mountains, who moved up and down regularly. Herodotus, without going into it, I wrote a whole study on it one time, all I'm pointing out at this point is that the identification, first of all, the identification of Meshech and Tubal as